Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Nancy Leake is a retired librarian and author of books on California history. Her first book, John Bidwell, The Adventurous Life of a California Pioneer, is a short biography for all ages. She then began publishing a series of picture book biographies for young readers with full cover illustrations by Steve Fershad. Nancy Leake, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, there must be so many books written on John Bidwell. Why did you want to write a book on John Bidwell?
Well, there aren't so many books about John Bidwell. There's one that was done back in the 40s. And then there's the one that Mike Magliari and Mike Gillis did, which is excellent, but it's not the book that you can't give it to a fourth grade student. Most adults don't want to read that long a book. But when I decided to do this book, because I saw that need for a shorter biography of Bidwell, I got Mike and Mike's book, as I think of it, and read through it. And because at the time, I didn't really know any more about John Bidwell than anybody who had toured the mansion. I didn't grow up here in Chico. And I read through his book, and I'm going, oh, this is fantastic. This guy had an amazing life. You know, there's adventure, there's achievements. I thought, this is a great story. This is a great story that more people ought to know about.
So the title of this book is John Bidwell, The Adventurous Life of a California Pioneer. You later wrote a book about John Bidwell and his wife, Annie. But this book about John Bidwell, your first one, I think should be on every Chico resident's bookshelf because it is a concise, it's very readable. And I'm thinking, yep, there's a librarian for you, making it very readable visually. And you include a lot of photographs, which make it all the more interesting and real.
Yes. Well, you know, I'm a librarian. I enjoy doing the research. and it is thoroughly researched. And Mike Magliari read through it for me, gave me a lot of good suggestions, too.
Yeah, yeah. And he's the one that wrote a big, thick book on John Bidwell. Now, I mentioned that you had served on the board of directors for the Bidwell Mansion, and you've done this for a long time.
So, well, it was Mike who snaffled me into that, yes.
I'm not surprised because he's on that board, too.
He was, yes.
But with what has happened recently with the fire of this mansion that John Bidwell built, people must be saying, Nancy, what's going to happen to the ruins? Are we going to rebuild? What do you have? What do you feel about that?
It's kind of interesting. I do take care of the BMA's Facebook page. And we have already gotten people offering us Victorian furniture. Well, of course, that's way in the future. We have no place to store anything. So people can hold off on that. it's a great shame that we lost the mansion. It really is. It is the emblem of Chico. And what will happen is largely up to state parks, because it is state parks property, with also input from the Office of Historic Preservation and the Machupta tribe and the community of Chico. So it will, I can see rebuilding it. That could be done. I wouldn't mind having it back, and I hate to see, you know, bad actors control things by burning things down and then they're just gone. On the other hand, I do think it's an opportunity to sort of widen the vision of what John Bidwell accomplished. He was on Rancho Chico nearly 20 years before the mansion was built. There were other buildings. There were other people. There were lots of other people. And they have a story, too. And I think when people toured the mansion, they
made... Now, did you lead tours? Because
no.
I've seen you in costume,
yeah,
Nancy,
yeah. I've done,
dressed in period wear.
I've done reenactment-type things,
yes.
But I never did tours. But when people toured the mansion, what they largely got out of it was gracious living in a Victorian home, which is fine. And the guides do try to, you know, educate about the history of the Bidwells. But Bidwell's life was so much more than that mansion. He was very prominent in politics, in education, in agriculture, and there's just a bigger story to tell about both the Bidwells and the other people on the Rancho.
My guest is Nancy Leake, and she is a retired librarian, but she is a historian, California history, but also especially Chico history, and she has written books about John and Annie Bidwell. So I think she's a perfect person to ask what maybe is down the road for this property that is right here in the heart of Chico, that those of us who lived here were touched by its presence, even if we didn't realize it until we lost it. So do people ask you, what kind of questions do they ask you that their thoughts about who this man was, John Bidwell? What kind of questions do you get about John Bidwell?
Other than asking whether they were going to rebuild the mansion, which I can't say, of course, who knows.
If you had a chance to kind of set some facts straight, say, oh, no, you know, you guys are kind of mistaken about this. This is what the truth is about John Bidwell. Does that come up that people have misconceptions that you might like to say, oh, no, that's not quite right?
Well, yes. It's easy to put anybody in the past into the same basket with everybody else you don't like from the past, say. And John Bidwell does not fit very well into that basket of bad actors. Yes, he owned a rancho, and yes, he employed the Machupta. But he was a very forward-looking, progressive man. He wanted to improve educational opportunities. He was interested in agricultural diversity. He did want to see the Machupta be able to adapt and assimilate into the white society. That's why he and Annie insisted that the school district allow Indian children into the schools, because they hadn't up until, you know, for some time they provided a separate school. The Bidwells provided a separate school, but they thought they ought to go to school with all the rest of the children.
So everybody should have an education regardless of their skin color.
And everybody should have an equal opportunity. And he, of course, also as part of the Prohibition Party platform, but supported women's suffrage. He believed women should have the vote.
And you know what? I sometimes wonder that if women had had the vote then, maybe he wouldn't, because he ran for president. He ran for governor of California. He ran for president. And maybe if women had the vote, the results would have been different, you think?
Well, that was, you know, temperance was largely a women's issue. And yeah. And he was very supportive of it because he wanted to support Annie.
Now, this person was here in California when the Civil War came, not just fought back in the East Coast, but out here there were Southern sympathizers.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
And you tell us in your book that a couple of them planned to kill Bidwell.
He, you know, seemed to have gotten death threats more than once.
But he stood up for what he felt was right.
Oh, yes.
And he was anti-slavery.
He was anti-slavery. He was, you know, sort of anti-Chinese. He employed Chinese workers.
Because there were some people murdered, Chinese.
The Lem Ranch murders, yes.
Yeah. And so when Bidwell wants to do something about that, you know, track down the murders of that, then his own life is in danger.
Yeah, that is true. And people said, maybe you ought to get out of town, but
yeah,
he wasn't.
You better go get out of here. You're going to get killed.
He wasn't going to do that. No.
Well, he began construction on this mansion that our community has lost to fire. And it was quite, on the leading edge, I think, of houses being constructed then. It was three stories, for one thing. When did he start building this?
1865. It was largely built while he was in Congress. So he was back in Washington, D.C. And it was, for its time, the most modern home north of Sacramento. There wasn't anything like it.
And you tell us it was the largest home in California north of Sacramento.
I think so. And it had all the modern conveniences. He wanted all the best things that he saw in, you know, homes back east and in fine hotels and so forth. So, the lighting, the plumbing, all of that was very modern.
Modern plumbing right here in the 1865.
And he, of course, when he started it, he had not yet met Annie. He was still a bachelor. I have a suspicion he was building it because he wanted to become governor, and he needed a home that was suitable for a governor, and the old adobe wasn't it. But he must have felt lucky that he was building it when he met Annie, because by the time he got her to consent to marry him, he had a house appropriate for, you know, a well-brought-up lady from Washington, D.C.
My guest is retired librarian and California historian Nancy Leake. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, historian Nancy Leake, who knows all about the Bidwells and Bidwell Mansion. She serves on the board of the Bidwell Mansion Association. And one of the books that I think should be on everybody's shelf, Chico, is entitled John Bidwell, The Adventurous Life of a California Pioneer. And I think if they would just, it doesn't take long to read this book. It's for adults, children, any age. And just looking at some of the photographs, and you can learn a lot about the history from this book. Now, you mentioned the Machupta Indians. And before John met Annie, there were Indian women living on his property. And sometimes I've heard maybe he married or he had children, because he and Annie did not have children.
No, and nobody knows why, because people didn't discuss those things back then, so we don't know. As far as the Machupta connection, I would say the definitive answer is probably.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yes, he was here from about 1844-45 on. He became acquainted with the Machupta, who were, you know, had their village near where he was trying to start a farm. And when the gold rush came, he employed them in mining. And he employed them on the farm, too. He probably did make a connection, that kind of relationship with a Machupta woman. But the problem is there's no documentation whatsoever. It's never mentioned in any letters, diaries, newspaper articles, there's no DNA evidence. So, you know, even amateur historians like myself like to see documentation.
Yeah.
And that doesn't exist. But still, it's very likely that he had probably two children, George Clements and Amanda Wilson. And it's quite possible that the reason Annie became very interested in those two in particular, and especially Amanda, and her daughter Maggie, who was very close to Annie, was probably because she saw Maggie, for instance, as Bidwell's granddaughter. We don't know that. She never says that. Maggie never says that. But, you know, the street that runs by the mansion, between the mansion and the creek, is called Sewillino Avenue. That, just that little short, you know, thing that runs into the campus. It used to be longer. That was Maggie's Indian name. That was her Machupta name. And Annie, in her diary, in a notebook, kept a little list of Machupta personal names and some common words. She was trying to, you know, learn some vocabulary. And Sewillino was Maggie's name. And so she named, when Maggie died, which was very sad, she died shortly after she married, just after a child was born, and the child died, and she died, and Annie was devastated. So she named that street after her.
Well, that's a sad part of the story, but there are things in your book that made me laugh. They had John Bidwell grew wheat, so he could make flour. But some visitors were there, and they ate these delicious pancakes there at the Bidwells. How about some more of those pancakes? And and the cook said, "Well, we're out of grasshoppers." Grasshoppers.
Well, of course, yes. The Indians gathered grasshoppers and dried them and ground them into meal. And this would have been during the Gold Rush, sometime around 1852, 50-something. And in his adobe, you know, right across the street, it was a hotel, it was his office, it was a tavern, and he was, you know, serving breakfast, and they were eating grasshopper pancakes, and wouldn't you like to try them?
Well, that might be the answer these days,
yeah.
Ground up insects.
Yep.
Well, there was another time that I thought was funny, too, was John Bidwell had to get information, this going back even earlier now. This guy that spoke Spanish, and he said, "Well, John, you need, if you're going to pan for gold," he said, "you need this, and the word you spell in the book is B-A-T-E-A." And John said, "Oh, what in the world is that? It must be some kind of machine. We'll have to go to Mexico and get this machine, or I'll go to the East Coast. I'll go through the Panama Canal and get
this." Yeah, because the Yankees can build anything.
Yeah, the Yankees can build anything, so they must be able to build a batea.
Yeah, I don't understand why Bidwell couldn't get the concept of a simple bowl.
That's what it was.
Washing, you know, the gold out of the sand. But he had learned Spanish. As soon as he got here, he knew he had to learn Spanish, and he did. But he was working on Sutter's Hawk Farm with this man, Pablo Gutierrez, and Pablo says, there's gold in the Bear River. He says, "I'm sure it's there. It looks just like Mexico, you know, and there's gold in Sonora." But
so
he just couldn't get the concept of a batea, and poor Pablo got captured as a spy during the Mitchell-Torena War and was hung. And I feel really sad for him because he was trying to get his own rancho on Bear River, and he lost it.
Yeah. So all this was just a wooden or metal bowl. It seemed like he could have just used his hands to say, "Hey, John, this is what you need. You need this thing, a bowl." Well, it wouldn't have said a bowl, to pan gold.
Yeah, I don't know. But that was the big story that John Bidwell told about it.
Well,
anyway.
He came on the first wagon train out to California. So he was a young guy. He lives several years before he meets Annie Bidwell. And what was the age difference?
20 years.
And so he had to be persistent.
He did. And Annie had this very affectionate family. She was a real homebody.
And by the way, what was her maiden name?
Oh, her maiden name was Kennedy.
Kennedy.
Different Kennedys.
Yeah.
People often ask me about that. You know, is she one of those Kennedys?
They, yeah.
No, no connection that I know of.
But these days you might gasp, He married a Kennedy.
He did, yes.
So Annie was a good bit younger than John was, and you have photographs of them at different ages, first in her wedding dress, and people might be surprised that her wedding dress was not white.
That wedding dress, that painting hung in the mansion, and it's gone, which is such a shame. But yes, she had this lovely blue and pink trimmed wedding gown, because ladies then would usually, their wedding gown would become their best evening gown. So it wouldn't...
Just put it in the attic and forget about it because it was your wedding day had passed.
Right. You were going to use that again and you wanted it to be, you know, suitable for a ball.
So you mentioned that that's one of the things that were lost in the fire. And some of the larger items had been removed for the renovation of the mansion, in my understanding.
No. Now, the majority of the furniture was not Bidwell furniture. It was not original. Very little had been actually taken out during the restoration. It's, you don't want to move things if you don't have to. And so they just, you know, protected them but didn't move them. And things that were lost were the paintings that were on the walls, like the huge portrait of John Bidwell and Annie in her wedding dress and some other paintings, the books in the library, including a set called The History of Women's Suffrage, inscribed to Annie by Susan B. Anthony. That was lost. John Bidwell's taxidermy cabinet in his office, a beautiful display of local wildlife, mostly birds. And that's gone. It really is a shame to lose those kind of things because they had not been moved. Yeah. Annie's piano was also original. It was her piano.
Yeah, that is a shame. And if even if they reconstructed the exterior that made it look like the original mansion, these treasures are gone.
Yeah, some things don't come back. There were Indian baskets. I mean, you could have reproductions or you could have other authentic period pieces. But would it be the same? I don't know.
Well, do you want to speculate on what might be in the future for this property here in the heart of Chico?
You know, I really don't want to speculate at this point. Well, I'm not sure what I want myself, let alone what is likely to happen. Whatever happens will take a long time. And they will be looking for input from the community, and I think that's important.
Well, is there anything you would like us to know as members of this community, but as your parting words for us today?
Well, read this part of this letter from...
Yes.
Okay, this is a letter that John Muir wrote. John Muir, the naturalist, the conservationist, wrote in 1905... to a gentleman, Dr. Benjamin, who was writing a biography of Bidwell. And he said, "Dear sir, of all the Californians I know, General Bidwell, in my opinion, most deserves a place in Statuary Hall." That's Statuary Hall in the U.S. Capitol,
Washington, D.C.,
where each state has two representative statues. And I won't read the whole letter, but he says, "The Bidwell was not the only man to strike root and grow high and broad in the mighty West, goes without saying, but he has always been in sight as a patriarch of the old style, steadfast, upright, towering in massive grandeur of character amid his fellow pioneers like a sequoia amid its companion firs and pines. And so I think his name will stand in history, a benevolent master builder, California's grand old man." And Bidwell himself...
And again, these are the words of John Muir.
These are words of John Muir, who was a friend of the Bidwells. Annie continued to correspond with him until, I don't remember which one of them died first. But Bidwell himself, in 1891, I believe, he gave a talk to the Society of California Pioneers, of which he was a member. And he concluded by saying, "The history of California lies like a map before me. Somewhat confused it may be, but I have seen it all." And he had seen so much California history from 1841 to 1900. He was very involved in early government and exploration and agriculture and so forth, he really makes a good lens to look at California history, to see California history in its early days.
I so agree with you, Nancy. My guest has been Nancy Leake. She is a retired librarian and history buff. And her book that you probably would like to have a copy of is called John Bidwell, The Adventurous Life of a California Pioneer. Thank you, Nancy Leake.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
After a break, I'll be talking to local author David Brune, who writes books now about competitive running. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Chico author David Brune was a competitive runner at American River College, autumn of 1976, before a torn ACL on his left knee ended his competitive running. He enlisted in the Navy and served aboard six ships and did two tours at the Pentagon. After his military service, Commander Brune returned to Chico and became a high school teacher and track coach. David Brune has written 27 books on naval history, two on leisure activities, and now a fourth book on competitive running in the 1970s. In his latest book, we learn the importance of California junior colleges like American River College and Butte College to competitive runners. Because Commander Brune was only at American River College for one semester, he invited its coach, Al Beta, to be his co-author for the new book, Beavers, American River College's Running Dynasty, 1964 to 1969. David Brune, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, why did you write this book? You've written a lot of other books. Why did you write another book?
Well, it's interesting. A couple of years ago, one of my teammates from 1976 found me and told me that they were having reunions and invited me, and I went to that one. And this past summer, Coach Beta came up to me, and he used to give the travel squad itineraries that had tactics and philosophy when we go to away meets. And he asked me if I would take some excerpts from those and put them together in some form that he could give them to his granddaughters, maybe runners at reunions. And after thinking about it, I decided that his legacy and his powerhouse program was deserving of a book. And I had done 35 books, and I was not going to do any more. I was basically, over a period of 27 years, I was going to close the chapter of that. I think this is an important book, and I'm glad I did it.
Well, he happened to have also been in the Navy, but that's not why you asked him to be your co-author.
No, he was actually a reluctant co-author. The reason I wanted to make him a co-author was in the book or excerpts from his itineraries. And as he reviewed the book, there's also his current perspective and thoughts on individuals and situations, and those are in the book in highlighted blocks. And so obviously this book couldn't be done without him. And he did not want to be on there. He's very modest. And then he said, well, okay, but, you know, put me down as a contributor. And I actually had that on the front cover, but the publisher wasn't having anything to do with that. So he's a co-author.
Well, people might wonder, okay, David Brune's here in Chico in the studio. Where's the co-author? Why isn't he sitting down here with us?
He's in Sacramento.
And also, he's not a youngster.
No, it's interesting. So Coach Al Beta is 91 years old, and if somebody told you he's 71, you'd believe that. him and his wife, Patty, are always on the go, great zest for life. And I'll just tell a quick aside. So one of his former athletes posted online that he weighs 145 pounds, which is probably close to his racing weight at Cal. He graduated from UC Berkeley in 1955. He can bench press 195 pounds, and he wants to do 200 pounds at the age 100. So he's in great shape, and he runs on a treadmill. He told me at his age that he's supposed to not get his heart above 105, but he says, I get up to 125. So anyway, so.
My guest is David Brune, Commander David Brune. And he was a competitive runner in his youth, and he went to American River College. Now, why did you choose to go there?
Well, it's interesting. I write about a little bit about that. I went to Butte College for a year, attended Butte College, and I ran. And somehow I found out about Coach Bate and his great program. I'm not sure how. There was a couple Chico State runners that were former Beavers. American River College Beavers. Carl Shackerly and Greg Griffin. And I used to train with Chico State occasionally when I was a high school kid. I probably learned about him. And it was interesting. I was thinking back, and I don't think I ever contacted him and said, hey, could I come be part of your program? I had a friend just drop me off in Sacramento, you know. And
so that's where American River College is located. In Sacramento.
Yes, and I got there in August, and we were training before school started, and the runners there were so good. I was so impressed by them and by him. I mean, I loved it. It was great.
And when you say you were impressed by him, what impressed you about Al Beta?
He's incredibly knowledgeable. He's always incredibly enthusiastic. He could psych us up and get us to do things you wouldn't think was possible. And most running coaches have a one-size-fits-all training program. They come up, they plan their workouts. He was able to figure out exactly what each person required to optimize their performance. We had one individual, he was a 408 miler. If he ran over 50 miles a week, he would be injured. We had another individual, Art Bowden-Distel, my teammate, who once told me I could run 130 miles on pavement and not get hurt. So Al Beta was a great runner at Cal back in the early 50s, and he was able to just tailor-make workouts for the athlete. Of course, mm-hmm. We trained together. The other thing that he did was great. We had 31 people out for cross country in 76, and only seven made the travel squad, went to away meets. And I didn't know until I was researching this book that the runners that weren't on the travel squad, he was arranging other meets and invitationals to take them to separately from the top runners so that they would have the experience of competing, which is great. The other thing, part of those 31 were sprinters, you know, so there were people there that weren't distance runners, but they were building a foundation for track, so.
Well, I think you mentioned that he was coached there 32 years, and he was really successful. His cross-country runners and also his track and field runners were quite successful. You quote percentages in your book.
Yeah, the percentages are in there. I forget. They're really high. It's 90, you know, these, for conference, and those percentages actually came out of he was inducted into the Sacramento Runners Hall of Fame, and they had him. But it was like in the 90s for conference champions, and it was in the high 80s for track. But what was really
You said in your book, 92% for cross country, 89% track and field. Those are high percentages.
But what was really notable is the state championships in cross country, he was really known for his distance runners. The top five junior colleges from the north, you'd have to get the top five in the Northern California Championships, and the Southern California ones top five, and then they would meet and it'd be top 10. And American River College was a large junior college, so they had a large community college state championship, and then they had a separate one for smaller ones, and at some point they combined. But his teams made the state meet 22 years in a row. So they were ARC, American River College, was among the top five for 22 years.
Wow. Well, people might say, well, why not go to a major? Why not go to Berkeley? Why not go to a four-year school? Why would I want to go to a junior college, David?
Well, that's interesting because back then, California has such great weather and the population is so great that they produce blue-chip athletes, the best of the best, Lots and lots and lots.
But this, the weather would be at a four-year college or a...
All right, but I'm getting to that point. So anyway, so back in the day, the blue-chip athletes would get scholarships. And then the next tier, a lot of them would go to junior colleges with the hopes that they would get a scholarship out of that. Now what happens these days, a lot of the second tier, they're given full rides at four-year colleges in the Midwest on the East Coast. You know, they go... Look at all these great athletes in California. Let's offer them scholarships and bring them back to our school.
Now, you mentioned great athletes because there's somebody that you mentioned in your book that distinguished himself on the football field, but he was a runner. I'm talking about O.J. Simpson, and he ran 100-yard dash.
Yes. What it's interesting in doing this research and looking at these Northern California and state meet results, there are a lot of great athletes that started off at junior colleges. O.J. Simpson was one. Lee Evans was one. John Powell was an Olympic medalist in the discus. He was at American River College.
So you get Olympians and NFL players who often got their start as athletes at a junior college.
Right, and you do not know that because it's not in their resume. It's not in their biographies. You know, usually people have, including myself, it has the four-year college you graduated from, and if you have master's degrees or a doctorate, where you went. But rarely do you find, you know, Aaron Rodgers is an exception, quarterback of the Green Bay Packers, well, lately the Jets. You know, he wears a Butte College sweatshirt because he's proud of having gone to Butte and being part of the football program. But generally, you don't see that. So you don't recognize how important junior colleges are in the development of athletes and in academics.
My guest is Commander David Brune, and he has written another book about runners in the 1970s. The title of his newest book, Beavers, American River College's Running Dynasty, 1964 to 1979. And I'm thinking parents or grandparents out there who are saying, well, I've got a young girl, why would she want to go to a junior college? And I once for 4 years taught at a junior college, and the drama department was quite strong. And one young woman who could have gone to the University of Georgia, but she chose this junior college because the likelihood of her getting a major role was much greater at the junior college than it was at a big university. Now, does that hold true, you think, for junior colleges and other fields other than runners?
I'm certain it does, but let me just say something more about Al Beda. So this book only covers half of his tenure at American River College. I had intended to cover his entire 32 years, but it wouldn't fit in one book. So that's why it's 64 through 79 instead of 64 through 96. But one of the interesting things about Al Beda, obviously, Olympic coaches, Olympic programs, they can pick anybody in the country. And obviously, you know, probably a lot of times those people come from prestigious four-year schools. They reached down in 1992 and selected Al Beda out of a community college to be a team manager and coach for the 1992 men's Olympic track and field team. And then 4 years later in 96, he was chosen as a team leader. At that time, I believe they'd never gone down to a community college level. It may not have since. So that tells you, here's this superlative coach that loves Sacramento, that grew up in Sacramento, that chooses to remain where he is because he loves it. And everybody that was associated with him benefited from it. And I'm sure that same model is across other junior colleges, different programs.
Gina, I have a friend whose daughter is now a senior in high school. She's looking at colleges, but I don't think she's looking at junior colleges. Maybe parents and grandparents out there listening say, my child would like to go, would benefit by choosing a junior college to attend, especially if this person is an athlete.
Well, the other thing that's interesting is like Al Beda went to McClatchy High School in Sacramento, and then he went to Sacramento City College, junior college, and he got recruited by Cal, and he ran for Cal. James Robinson, there's a story in the book of James Robinson was America's best half miler for a number of years. He started off at a junior college, and there's a Beaver in here that finished second to him in the state race. Tim Bryant ran a 149 half mile. But anyway, so he went to Cal. So there's all, you know, and Aaron Rodgers came out of Butte College, and he went to Cal. So, you know, and A little aside, that I heard a story about Aaron Rodgers. The Cal scout actually came to Butte College to scout somebody else and saw Aaron Rodgers throwing the football. And then, you know, next thing you know, he's at Cal. So,
yeah. So maybe this is another thing people might learn from listening to what you have to say, is if they look at their resume and say, you know, I didn't put my junior college down there. I only put the college that I got my bachelor's degree from. Maybe I should reconsider that, because maybe it's time we reconsider the importance of junior colleges and the role they play. Yeah, I had made a note about James Robinson, who was a national junior, set a national junior college record, and you mentioned Tim Bryan, and you have a lot of photographs in your book, as you might expect, and they're great pictures because they're action shots.
Yep.
And you have on the back cover, you have a shirt with the Beavers colors and runners.
Yeah, that's Bob Dice and Rich Langford, and they were great runners. Rich Langford was a state junior college champion in the steeplechase, and Bob Dice was second in the mile at the state championships. And they were there actually training with us when I was there in 76. They'd graduated, but they got scholarships to Fresno State Division I school. And there's an account in there by Bob Dice about Fresno State beating Stanford in a track meet. And Bob Dice going to the coach and saying, I guarantee you, he'd run the mile earlier in the meet, and he was doubling back in the 2 mile. And he had to get, I think, third or better for them to win the meet. And he won the 2 mile, but he guaranteed his coach a first victory ever over Stanford. So
now, since you mentioned Bob Dice, he wrote one of the forewords. You have three people writing forewords for your book. And he talks about the reason for this book. And he mentioned goals for runners. And do you remember what he was saying about goals for runners?
Well, he was talking about there's a couple important things. One is PRs, runner slang, personal records. You know, he's basically making the point, different people have different abilities, obviously. And so what's important is that you're always trying to improve your personal best, your personal record. And the other thing he talked about in that interview was about you also need to learn to deal with defeat. And he cites the Rolling Stones, you know, stanza, you can't always get what you want. That's another important life lesson. But he's basically talking about how being in a competitive environment and working hard and doing all that put you in good stead. And I didn't go into a lot of details in his book, but he also had some medical issues that put him in the hospital. And he basically said, I could deal with that because of my, you know, muscle memory and my, basically, he didn't say it, but mental toughness that I developed as an athlete.
Yeah. Well, you know, I had grown up, I played tennis. And when I took up running, I happened to be visiting my parents and my dad after I came back from a race. And he said, well, did you win? Because in tennis, you either win or you lose. And I paused for a moment. I said, yeah, I didn't come in first by a long shot. I'm not a fast runner. But I thought, yeah, I did. And I think there's, like you were just mentioning, you are competing, but it's a different kind of competition than other competitions, if I want to say it that way. Now, people might be wondering, well, David, you've only been talking about guys. What about girls? Didn't they run?
Well, at American River College, there's a girl on the cover who's now in her 40s, Jennifer Schindler. She was a four-time state champion. She's the greatest American River College runner of all time. And those, her time there isn't covered in the book, but I made the point that she was a product of the programs that began in the late 70s. So in 1978, American River College introduced women's cross country. And the following spring, in the spring of 79, women's track and field. And there was a woman that was there for, she implemented those programs, and another woman, Jean Snuggs, took over. And Jean Snuggs, who I've met, is exactly like Al Beda. Enthusiastic.
And she was also a coach there.
Oh, yeah, and it's interesting because she was also a great coach. And then later she was the athletic director. You know, when I was talking to her, you know, and people are proud of being athletic directors, but I basically said, you know, for athletes, that doesn't matter. It's coach. That's the title that's most important. And I drew an analogy, so from my Navy.
You know, it's interesting. You have this photograph of this, she's a young blonde, on the cover. And so I'm reading through your book and kept thinking, well, when am I going to learn about her? But you were saying you didn't happen to.
Well, I think she's in the acknowledgments. But it's funny. Yeah. So when I met her, a signature, people were invited to autograph their pictures in a number of these books, athletes.
Yeah.
I go, you're so sweet looking. I mean, it's like you look at her on the cover of a book.
Does.
You know, you look like the sweetest,
she's no threat.
Sweetest little blonde girl you ever saw. And four-time state champ had to be. And she went on to the University of Washington and led their cross-country team. So she was great.
Well, and you mentioned Jean Snuggs, who was the women's head coach. And she talked about what she learned from Al Beta.
Yeah, that's in her Ford. And you want me to read that? I could thumb to it. Or you want to?
Well, if you remember what she said that she learned from Al Beta, because he just was an inspiration on so many levels, it seems, after reading your book about Al Beta.
Well, I can't cite that off the top of my head, but I will read this.
Okay.
So she says in her Ford, reflecting back, here is some of what I learned about coaching and life by working side by side with Coach Beta for 17 years. Every athlete counts, whether the athlete is a state champion or a novice. Know your stuff as a coach. Biometrics, techniques, rules, exercise physiology, etc., and never quit learning. Know your athletes. Coach the full person. Be alert to their spirit, performance, and attitude. Be flexible with workouts. What is planned and looks good on paper may not be ideal on a given day for every athlete. Individualize and or alter plans as needed. Finally, recognize and celebrate good performance, not just wins or scoring. And along those lines, I note in this book that one of my teammates, I think it was Bill Weed, he told me, so Coach Beta was also, he would coach jogging classes. And he would run with them, and he would run with us in workouts.
You have a photograph of
him. Yeah, and Bill Weed said one time, he said, he cares as much about and gets as excited about as the people in his jogging class as he does us, his top athletes. And just one aside that I talk about, you know, it was funny because we would go out and run like 6 miles at like 5:30-mile pace, which was easy. We just go out cruising along. And he would hang with us for Coach Beta for like 3 miles. And he was probably like 42 or 43 when I was there. And I used to think, how could this guy? We knew he'd run for Cal, but we didn't know how good he was. And he's so modest. So I'll just tell you. So I was sitting in his den when I was working on this book. And Kim Ellison was there, and 401 miler, and I'd
Kim, by the way, is a man.
Yeah, and I'd referred to them both as great athletes. And Al Beta turns to me, he says, David, I wasn't a great athlete. I only ran 1:52 in the half and 4:19 in the mile. Well, this was like 1955, the world's record. They hadn't broken 4-minute mile yet. And he ran the leadoff on a 4x880, 4x1/2 relay that broke the world's record. So Al Beta was a great athlete, but he's a very modest individual. And since we're talking about it, I've got to give over a quick story. So I'm doing this book, and I'm sending him information. He's reviewing it. I send him the preface, and the preface talks about him because I'm introducing him to the audience. And he gets a hold of me. He goes, David, I don't think I want you to do this book. I think I'd be embarrassed. I go, Coach, I'm introducing you to the readers in the preface, but when the book gets rolling, it's all about your Beavers. And so, you know.
Well, one thing that won me over, of course, I never knew this gentleman, but I thought of how you ended your last book, or toward the end of your last book. You gave compliments to your wife, who happens to be named Nancy. You had said some very sweet things about your wife, Nancy. And then we get to the end of your book here about Al Beta, and he says he wants to give a big bouquet of flowers to my loving wife of 57 years, Patty. He says, Patty, you remain my staunchest supporter. I love you more than chocolate. So I thought, okay, you two guys, maybe that's what running does for people. It makes you nice human beings.
Absolutely.
So thank you for writing this book.
Well, I've been married 41 years, and he's been married longer, so you learned some things. Well, let me read a couple things from his postscript just because it shows how much he cares about his athletes. He says, if you want to be a Beaver, just come along with me is the first stanza of an old song. It is so appropriate as I reflect on the incredible years I shared with you athletes. I did want all of you to come along with me and be Beavers. How lucky I am that you did. I loved coaching, but I loved all you athletes I coached more. How fortunate I was over the years to be with you on the trails and cross country and on the track in the spring. It couldn't have been better, and each of you made it happen. So that tells you right there.
Yeah. Yeah. So thank you for writing this book. And I think we learned a lot, even if people who aren't runners, there's things that we could take away from this book that you wrote. So thank you for writing this. The title of the book, again, is Beavers, American River College's Running Dynasty, 1964 to 1979. And the author is Commander David Brune.
Okay, thank you.
I would also like to thank my first guest, retired librarian and California historian Nancy Leek, who wrote about the Bidwells and Bidwell Mansion. And next we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
She'll do anything for food. She'll do anything for food, the dog walker tells me. She speaks quietly, not wanting to insult her heavy-boned, one blue, one brown-eyed beast tugging at her leash. We did a doggy ancestor test, she confides. Discovered she's part wolf, part miniature poodle. Must be the poodle part, makes her so ravenous. Small creatures are ruthless feeders. Think of enraptured rats gnawing their way through orange trees, babies nursing, sucking so fiercely they can burst a nipple. Think of your heart, size of a throbbing fist, the part of you that will do anything for love. Kim Dower.
Train passing. The melancholy sound of trains in passing. Their warnings ring hollow in the damp air, a reminder that life keeps moving on, destination unknown, slipping through our fingers like so much empty air. I unpack the groceries, the 1 pound bar of chocolate, and hug the cat. He's sleepy, unbothered, trusting what is to be enough. I look out the window and listen to the rain. Some say we're surrounded by angels. Perhaps I could hear one singing. Amy Gaffney.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.